Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with confirmation from Swiss scientists that PLO leader Yasser Arafat was poisoned by radioactive polonium and assess what impact this will have on the already shaky peace talks underway between Israelis and Palestinians. Khalid El-Gindi, a fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, who was an advisor to the Palestinian leadership from 2004 to 2009, joins us to discuss remarks by Secretary of State Kerry on Israeli television, where he warned of a bleak period ahead if peace is not achieved, stating, "I mean, does Israel want a third intifada?" Then we'll speak with Jared Bernstein, the former chief economic advisor to Vice President Biden and a member of President Obama's economic team. He has an article in Thursday's New York Times with Dean Baker taking aim at the wrong deficit. And we'll discuss how the exaggerated fears that the sky is falling due to budget deficits, which are in fact going down, are distracting Americans from a real problem with the trade deficit, which, if fixed, would help reduce the budget deficit. Then finally, we'll look into a flagrant and callous hypocrisy and national disgrace as the House debates cutting $40 billion more from the food stamp program that was just cut, while they plan to increase subsidies for billionaire owners of farms and agribusiness. We will speak with Craig Cox, the Senior Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources at the Environmental Working Group, who have just released a study revealing how billionaires with a collective wealth of $316 billion are receiving millions in taxpayer farm subsidies, while poor families with children are having their already inadequate allotment of food stamps cut. Joining us now is Khalid El-Gindi, who is a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. Welcome to Background Briefing, Khalid El-Gindi.
Thanks for having me.
And Khalid, what do you make of the Swiss scientists now confirming that tests show that the late Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat had high levels of radioactive polonium in his body?
Well, I think it's probably going to raise more questions than it answers. I think these are, in the first place, preliminary findings, and I don't think from a scientific standpoint that they're conclusive, but they are the strongest indication we've had so far of what Palestinians have long suspected, that Yasser Arafat was poisoned. And it's, you know, like I said, likely to raise more questions than it answers. It comes at a very sensitive moment when peace talks have not been going well already, and public confidence, Palestinian confidence in the process, I think, is already at a very low point. So this will only add pressure, I think, to the Palestinian leadership.
Well, apparently, in terms of the credibility of these new reports from the Swiss scientists at the Vaudoise University Hospital Center in Lausanne, Switzerland, Professor François Bouchoud says that the high levels of polonium detected by definition indicate third-party involvement, but he wouldn't confirm whether polonium was the cause of the death, but he did indicate that there were some problems with the chain of custody of the specimens, but they were taken apparently from both his body and the soil surrounding his body. And the Swiss scientists say that the polonium found was 18 times higher than normal. So right. I imagine this is not going to go away, right? This is not something that's definitively ruling it out or in.
That's correct. I mean, it's definitely not going away. And, you know, here we are 9 years after Arafat's death. And it's still out there, and I think it has the potential to damage not just Israel, assuming, of course, that there's any Israeli involvement, but also the Palestinian leadership if they're not seen to be following up. And I think, you know, the Palestinian public has, for the most part, already concluded long ago that Arafat was poisoned or that he was basically assassinated by Israel. They believe that. And I think many in the leadership believe that. It's a question of whether they want to pursue it or not given the sensitivity, given the current peace talks, given the sensitive nature of the issue with regard to the United States. And I think it's it puts the Mahmoud Abbas, I think, in a very difficult position.
Again, let me remind the audience that we're speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. So just to go back to Arafat's death, he fell violently ill in October 2004 in his compound in the West Bank. And then 2 weeks later, he was flown to a French military hospital in Paris, where he died on November 11th at the age of 75. The French medical authorities said he died from a stroke resulting from a blood disorder. But then a murder inquiry was launched in August of 2012. And then, of course, Suha Arafat, the widow, objected to a postmortem at the time of his death, but then she later agreed to his body being exhumed a year ago to, as she said, to reveal the truth. So that's the sort of, you know, the background to where we are at the moment, or where, how we got to where we are at the moment. So obviously, you know, you've said that it's bound to have an impact. Kerry, the Secretary of State Kerry, has warned Israel of troubles ahead if the peace talks failed. And just a couple of days ago, Prime Minister Netanyahu suggested that the Palestinians were bringing up extraneous issues and weren't being serious. And my understanding of the impasse is that the Israelis feel that, well, now the expectation on the Palestinian side was that the release of prisoners, which was highly welcomed by the Palestinians, would be tied to a freeze on settlements. But the Israelis are basically saying, no, the release of prisoners is not tied to settlements, and they're doubling down on settlements. So is that where the impasse is?
I think the impasse, obviously, we don't know for certain what's happening inside the negotiating room. Both sides have done a fairly good job of staying quiet and keeping leaks to a minimum. But I think there are multiple impasses, if you will. From what I can gather, the negotiations themselves have not progressed into serious substantive matters, such as where Jerusalem would be divided, what exactly will the fate of the refugees. I think they're still hung up on procedural issues on one hand, but also they're sort of talking around the margins of these core issues like final borders and Jerusalem and refugees, such that the Palestinian side is very frustrated. The Israeli side has publicly said, or at least officials on the Israeli side have said, that Jerusalem is not on the table, for example. So that's one issue, is the talks themselves are not progressing. But I think the dramatic spike in settlement activity since the talks began, and even during Secretary Kerry's shuttle diplomacy over the summer, I think has been the most immediate cause of frustration, both on the part of the Palestinians and the American officials who are involved. And the talks did not require, there wasn't a quid pro quo. Israel didn't agree to freeze all settlement activity. It's one of the things that the Palestinian leadership is being criticized for, is why would you enter negotiations without an assurance that Israel wouldn't continue to expand settlements? But it was something that they decided to do given the American pressure and so on. So the talks have hung up on a lack of substance, on ongoing settlement activity, and I think this just adds to the mix of ill feeling and lack of trust.
Well, it seems that Secretary of State Kerry was unusually blunt in an interview with Israel's Channel 2, which was recorded in Jerusalem just before he left for Amman, Jordan, where he is now, that Kerry said, "I mean, does Israel want a third intifada? if we do not find a way to find peace, there will be an increasing isolation of Israel. There will be an increasing campaign of delegitimization of Israel that has been taking place on an international basis. So the idea of a third intifada, that's really pretty provocative, isn't it? No, you know, I mean, has anybody said that that was going to happen? Is that the, what the Palestinian people feel is their last resort?
Well, I mean, of course, it's, you know, the idea of a third intifada has been out there for a long time, and some people have predicted that after the Arab uprisings, you know, Palestine would inevitably be next. And there have been moments of protests, sometimes directed at the occupation, sometimes directed at their own leadership, but it hasn't really gained traction. I think, you know, for all the ingredients to be there for a third intifada, there are a number of things that have to, I think it's not just one event. It's a series of factors that sort of come together and create, you know, the perfect storm, if you will. And we're not quite at that point, but what I think Kerry is trying to do is to inject a sense of urgency in the talks, as well as to express, I think, a degree of frustration with the fact that they haven't progressed further than they have. And it is not unreasonable to expect that if the peace talks aren't going anywhere, that eventually the Palestinian street, the ordinary Palestinians who are growing more and more frustrated, who are losing more and more land to the settlements, it's not unreasonable to expect that they would take matters into their own hands. You know, Palestinians are no strangers to uprisings, obviously. It's a question of whether the political process can be an alternative. For the time being, I think there isn't a desire to kind of take to the streets. Palestinians have paid a very high price for past uprisings, particularly the last one a decade ago, in which their institutions were systematically destroyed. There were enormous civilian casualties, and I think Palestinians are not eager to rebel, but in the end, when you have a frustrated population that sees no political horizon, no way out, that it may in fact be inevitable. And I think that's what Secretary Kerry was expressing.
Well, apparently he had a bit of a tense exchange with the Israel Channel 2 anchor, Udi Segal, who referred to Netanyahu's release of dozens of long-term prisoners, saying to Kerry, how do you think a picture of Mahmoud Abbas hugging murderers that killed children 20 to 30 years ago and say that they're heroes of the Palestinian people, what kind of message do you think that is sent about the peace process or peace atmosphere to the Israeli people? And Kerry responded saying, it's very difficult, I have no illusions, but the alternative to getting back to the talks is the potential of chaos. I mean, does Israel want a third intifada? That's the context for that remark.
Right. I think the secretary is expressing a sense of frustration and trying to convey a sense of urgency about this process, because the Americans really see no alternative to this process, and they have no contingency plan for if and when this process breaks down. So I think there's a lot riding on it from the U.S. perspective.
But Khaled Al-Gindi, you previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and you were a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. So you've been on the inside, and my sense of this so-called peace process is that it's a peace process. It's not about peace. It's a process. It goes on inevitably. So when you say Kerry's frustrated by the negotiations, my question to you is, what more is there to negotiate? They've been negotiating for decades, for God's sake.
That's true. And I think you touched on a point that is a source of Palestinian frustration, is and so many other observers of this process, including many Israelis, who see a lot of process, and of course, there's been no peace. This was the Oslo process was supposed to end in 1999, and here we are 15 years later, and it's still going. Even though ostensibly all sides agree on what the outcome will be, two states based on the 1967 lines, with some modifications in the border that are mutually agreed. And, you know, there's a broad international consensus on this. And so what is the stumbling block? The stumbling block, I think, comes down to there's a serious power imbalance between the sides. It's not enough simply to bring the parties to the negotiating table. You know, Israel is the strongest military in the region. It is the occupying power. It holds most of the cards. It is, if we're talking about ending the occupation and creating a Palestinian state, then the onus is really on Israel. There's not a lot that Palestinians can offer in terms of positive incentives to force Israel to take those steps. And that's where third parties come in. That's where the U.S. role is so critical. And so far, we haven't seen the United States really apply pressure on Israel to try and level the playing field a little bit. It may be waiting until later on in the process to do that, but so far it hasn't done that, hoping that the parties will have enough trust and create enough of a rapport with one another in the talks that they will both be forthcoming. But it's impossible at the end of the day to ignore that power imbalance, a very, very severe power imbalance. We're talking about the most powerful power in the region, which is Israel, against what is essentially the weakest party in the region. It's not even a state, and it's an occupied people.
And it's a divided state too.
A divided and occupied population. That's correct. And so there's a real weakness there. And so you know, this is not a conflict. The reason that there isn't a Palestinian state is not because they don't have institutions. You know, we often hear about, well, we need to build the Palestinian institutions and institution building is essential. Sure, that's part of it. But it's not the reason this process isn't succeeding. The reason is because Israel has very little incentive to change the status quo. The settlements are doing a brisk business. They're literally and figuratively. There's a lot of money to be made from continuing the occupation. Palestinian resources are being exploited, whether it's water or minerals in the Dead Sea or water from the Jordan Valley, natural gas off the coast of Gaza. These are, you know, underground water resources. These are all things that Israel basically gets for free by continuing the occupation. And it's been a very low-cost occupation. There isn't a high price to pay at this time in terms of blood and treasure. And so why would Israel change course when things seem to be going well for the Israeli economy? Things are calm. Israelis have security for the most part. And so why would they change that formula?
Well, Khaled El-Gindi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, who is a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how bogus fears over the budget deficit are distracting us from real problems with the trade deficit.